age personality assessments tell us something about mortality risk.
Probiotics not helpful for kids with gastroenteritis.
Can nurse practitioners and PAs give as good care as physicians when it comes to diabetes management?
And oral desensitization to peanuts is not nuts.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed Double T, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a medical journalist at Johns Hopkins, and this will be posted on November 23rd, 2018.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
All right. With an intro like it's not nuts from the New England Journal of Medicine, of course, a look at the strategy of feeding peanut powder to infants and desensitization to allergy.
Elizabeth, this is a big issue because peanut allergy is on the rise among kids and adults in the United States. In fact, once you have it as a kid, it persists into adulthood. It accounts for the majority of deaths related to food allergy. So the question is, once a child's developed it, is there a way to desensitize them so they can tolerate peanuts? There's a powder that's about 11.6% defatted peanut that allows us to get precise quantities of peanuts. They took 551 participants, most of whom were under age 17, and they put them on a desensitization where they got a small amount of peanuts and they gradually increased the dose over the course of a year. After they completed it, they challenged them to peanuts. They challenged them early to see what the largest amount they could tolerate, and then again at the end of the study. And there was a placebo arm as well. They received what looked for all the world like the powdered peanut, but it actually wasn't. And for individuals who are able to tolerate less than 1/6 of a peanut when they started, by the end of the therapy, those that received the oral desensitization, about 2/3 of them were able to tolerate as much as 2 peanuts, and about half of them as many as 4 peanuts. For those that got the placebo, it was less than 4%. And in those that received the oral desensitization, they were able to tolerate a larger dose of peanuts and had less severe allergic reactions. This is great evidence in a large patient population that in children, you can desensitize them. Now, by the way, there was a small group over the age of 17, and it really didn't work very well.
We've reported in the past, of course, about a strategy of feeding peanut powder to infants to try to forestall the development of these allergies. I'm wondering if the fact that older kids did not respond is evidence that we should start as early as possible.
This study doesn't particularly address it because it limited to kids between the ages of 4 to 17 and then older adults. But you're right. The study clearly showed that in the older adults, it wasn't nearly as effective as it was in the children aged 4 to 17.
Of course, we've talked before, and I'm still wondering what in the world is up with this increasing incidence of peanut allergy to begin with?
A great question. We've talked before about the fact that because of the world that we live in, there's less exposure to allergens at very young age. And if there's less exposure, those kids have more allergic reactions either to environmental agents or possibly to foods as well. The other possibility is they're being exposed to different types of foods, some of which may be manufactured or processed that sensitizes individuals. So a lot of theories, but we don't really know exactly why at this particular point.
Okay. Since we're talking about management strategies, let's turn to Annals of Internal Medicine. This really big study took a look at folks with type 2 diabetes and who was providing their primary care, whether that was nurse practitioners, physician assistants, or physicians themselves. 568 VA primary care facilities, 368,000 plus adult patients with diabetes who were on medicines. And they took a look at a number of outcome measures, including their control of hemoglobin A1C, their systolic blood pressure, and their low-density lipoprotein. And they said, are there differences if we are managed by a nurse practitioner, a physician assistant, or a physician? And the good news was, and I think it's good news since we're so concerned about the relative shortage of primary care physicians, there was no difference in those outcome measures among the folks treated regardless of who provided their care.
As you mentioned, this is a large study, almost 370,000 patients, geographically diverse, scattered among all the VA centers, that showed, again, no difference with regard to blood pressure, with regard to cholesterol or with regard to hemoglobin A1C between those three different providers. Now, in fairness, what the VA tries to do is they try to have a home-centered therapy. So it's not just these providers, but we have dietitians involved. We have therapists involved. So it's really a team approach. And what this study says is at the head of that team, regardless of whether it's physician, nurse practitioner, or a physician assistant, we can get very similar results. This is chronic disease management. It's not making an acute diagnosis. It's in a system that has an electronic medical record, so we can follow these patients. It has a team approach. And I think it does help address the issue of if we use what are called mid-level providers in these chronic disease management systems, can they get results that are equivalent to physicians? The answer is yes. So I would suggest perhaps we need to stop calling them mid-level providers because in this case, they're primary care providers and they did an excellent job.
In your clinical experience, would you suggest that other chronic conditions could also be effectively managed by this population?
Well, Elizabeth, I think what this says is they manage diabetic patients, but they manage their blood pressure, cholesterol. So these are other chronic conditions as well. They can manage heart failure and coronary artery disease. So for patients that have chronic disease conditions, when they're well-trained and operating in a team setting, I think they do a very good job.
Great study. Let's turn to your second one, back to the New England Journal of Medicine. What about probiotics, something that everybody is interested in right now in children?
So acute infectious gastroenteritis, it's a problem both in developing countries and in developed countries. In developed countries, it primarily results in an illness that takes kids out of school. They can get dehydrated. Sometimes they have to be admitted to the hospital. In fact, there are about 70,000 hospital admissions in the United States. We saw about 1.7 million kids in the emergency department. But in developing countries, it can actually be a life-threatening condition. There are a number of different organizations that make recommendations for managing gastroenteritis. About half of them recommend probiotics. The other half don't. And that's based upon a number of small trials or meta-analysis. Until these two trials, which were published back-to-back in the New England Journal of Medicine, we haven't had large series looking to see whether they're effective or not. So these two trials conducted in Canada and the United States were double-blind, placebo-controlled trials that compared the effectiveness of a probiotic called Lactobacillus rhamnosus in over 1,800 infants and kids that had acute gastroenteritis. In fact, in one of the trials, they actually supplemented that probiotic with another one called Lactobacillus helveticus. The long and the short outcome was that the probiotic did not, in fact, improve the outcome. It didn't lower the incidence of kids that had moderate to severe gastroenteritis. It didn't shorten the duration of the diarrhea. It didn't shorten the vomiting period as well. Didn't shorten the absenteeism or didn't shorten the number of kids that sought advice from a hospital or from a doctor.
I'm wondering about prophylaxis, and certainly there are many people who are attempting to consume probiotics themselves or feed them to their children to forestall these kinds of things.
Elizabeth, this study doesn't address that. Most of the infectious disease in these children was, in fact, viral, things like norovirus or rotavirus or adenovirus. There were very few bacterial infections. Again, this doesn't address that, but I think it's really strong evidence that at least these two probiotics, and we can't speak about other ones, which are over-the-counter and have been recommended by other organizations, aren't effective in treating acute gastroenteritis.
Okay, let's turn to our final one in the BMJ Open, and one that you disparaged, but one that tickles me. And the reason it tickles me is because it's just so big, and it started in 1960, which I think these things are really remarkable. Over 26,000 members of Project Talent, we have also talked about Project Talent data recently in another way, had a survey taken that included 10 personality scales and their socioeconomic status, as I said, in 1960. Average 48-year period of follow-up ending in 2009. And then they said, okay, what of these personality characteristics could predict actually mortality? So they looked at sex, the grade they were in at the time, and then levels of, I like this, vigor, calm, culture, maturity, and social sensitivity in high school. These were associated with reduced mortality risk, while higher levels of impulsivity were associated with greater mortality risk. I don't think this is surprising at all, but I think that the metrics themselves are really interesting that they picked those out. Also, with regard to the socioeconomic status, it does turn out, of course, that that's predictive, and we know that already, too. And it's more or less one of those things where personality and socioeconomic status are kind of equal. with regard to their impact. So interesting that characteristics that one demonstrates in high school may be predictive of one's mortality risk decades later.
As you noted, mortality is affected by socioeconomic status and, according to this study, personality traits. But even when they adjusted for the gender and for the grade and for socioeconomic status, personality still influenced mortality. And as you said, if you're more vigorous, if you're calm and you're mature, you're socially sensitive, your mortality was lower. If you're impulsive, your mortality was higher. I find it, again, interesting, but I'm not sure it's actionable. So I'm going to put that in your court. And the other thing I would say is probably one of the interesting things about this is most of the personality studies that have looked at associated mortality have been conducted in older individuals. So this suggests that even at a very young age, those personality traits may affect mortality. Do you actually think this is actionable, Elizabeth?
Maybe the identification of impulsivity in someone and kind of telling them, gosh, don't know if you know this, but you've got this high level of impulsivity, and that means that you might take more risks, you might choose behaviors that, like smoking or some drug use even, that are probably not going to result in a good impact with regard to your health. I don't know if those things would be something that would resonate for an individual or not. They would sure resonate for me, but of course, I'm only an N of one.
Well, you're right. Interesting, because some of those impulsive behaviors are those individuals that accomplish great things that you say, well, I'm risk averse. I would never do that. You might say, well, I'm not surprised that impulsivity is associated with mortality. Also, you might say that I'm not surprised impulsivity is associated with greatness as well. Interesting study from 26,000 kids. I'm glad you picked it and you talked about it instead of me.
On that note, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.